Today is Tuesday, October 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Both U.S. presidential candidates hit the campaign trail on Monday.
Hello, Sanford!
There's nothing beyond the capacity of this nation.
Plus, the WHO says relying on herd immunity is problematic.
Never in the history of public health has herd immunity been used as a strategy for responding to an outbreak, let alone a pandemic.
And Blackpink is heading online. We'll have all these stories and a whole lot more next. Both U.S. President Donald Trump and his Democratic Party opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, hit the campaign trail on Monday. Biden traveled to Ohio, a must-win state for the Republican incumbent, where polls are showing a tight race on November 3rd. For months, Trump has worked to shift public attention away from the coronavirus and his handling of the pandemic, which has infected nearly 7.7 million people in the United States. But Biden, in his remarks, zeroed in on that topic.
Trump panicked. His reckless personal conduct since his diagnosis has been unconscionable. The longer Donald Trump is president, the more reckless he seems to get.
Biden has tested negative for the coronavirus multiple times recently. Later in the day, Biden traveled to Cincinnati, where he said a unified America can't be stopped.
There's nothing beyond the capacity of this nation when we stand together. So it's time to stand up. Take back our democracy, unite, and let's, for the first time in a while, reflect the values that the vast majority of Americans hold.
It's Biden's second campaign trip in as many weeks to Ohio, which was once thought to be out of reach for the Democrat, but where polls now show a competitive race. Trump won the state by 8 percentage points 4 years ago, and no Republican has won the White House without carrying Ohio. President Trump traveled to Orlando, Florida, for his first of three scheduled campaign events this week.
Hello, Sanford! It's great to be with you. Thank you. It's great to be back.
In his remarks, Trump attacked Biden.
Joe Biden is also owned by the radical globalists, the wealthy donors, the big money special interests, who shipped away your jobs, shut down your factories, threw open your borders, and ravaged our cities while sacrificing American blood and treasure in this ridiculous, endless war, set of endless wars that we've been in for a long time.
Trump told his supporters that if he doesn't sound like a politician, it's because he's not, and that he's fighting harder for them than anyone has before. Earlier on Monday, his doctor said the president had tested negative for the coronavirus a week after Trump left the hospital where he was treated for COVID-19. The presidential election is 22 days away on November 3rd. President Trump's Supreme Court pick has told lawmakers that she is devoted to enforcing the rule of law and not creating the law. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
As her confirmation hearing began, appeals court judge Amy Coney Barrett summarized her conservative approach.
Americans of all backgrounds deserve an independent Supreme Court that interprets our Constitution and laws as they are written.
And in her opening statement to a Senate panel, pointed to the words of her late mentor, former Justice Antonin Scalia.
A judge must apply the law as it is written, not as she wishes it were.
Republicans are looking to fast-track Barrett's confirmation before next month's election, scheduling 4 days of hearings this week. Barrett would take Ruth Bader Ginsburg's high court seat, and Democrats like vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris are warning Ginsburg's decades of fighting to protect all Americans would be in jeopardy.
President Trump is attempting to roll back Americans' rights for decades to come.
Democrats are branding Barrett a threat to health care, arguing she'd vote to scrap the Affordable Care Act.
The results will be nothing short of catastrophic.
Patrick Leahy and others warning there's a reason President Trump wants Barrett on the court before it hears a challenge to the law known as Obamacare a week after the election. Sagar Magani, Washington.
World powers are calling for peace as the conflict continues between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. The territory is in Azerbaijan, but run by ethnic Armenians. Both sides claim it as their own. In the United States, members of both the Armenian and Azerbaijani diasporas are mobilizing to help their homelands. Anna Rice narrates this story.
Hip-hop singer Armin has spent the last few days in his Los Angeles store packing boxes of humanitarian aid to send to Yerevan, Armenia. It's part of an effort by the Armenian diaspora in the U.S. to help fellow Armenians back home.
The first few days, we were, you know, telling everyone, come drop off whatever you want to donate, medical supplies, medicines from, like, pharmacies, and then, of course, clothes. But by now, we let everybody know that really, if you want to help, the best way is monetary donation.
So far, the Armenian diaspora has raised tens of millions of dollars.
I think it was about 80 million. I'm sure by now, like, a couple of millions were added.
When fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh flared in recent days, both the Azerbaijani and Armenian diasporas mobilized to help. The Armenian diaspora includes more than 1.5 million people. Most of them live in California.
What we do is only a drop in the ocean. But this is a message of encouragement, a message of support and partnership with our brothers and sisters in Armenia and especially in Artsakh, to tell them that they are not alone.
The Azerbaijani diaspora has united to help their homeland.
About 50,100,000 Azerbaijanis live in the U.S. today. Our diaspora is young. Very few people have lived here for over 20 years. Mostly people came to the United States relatively recently. We are only just starting to build connections, and the current conflict has united us a lot.
The Azerbaijani community is raising money to send back to Azerbaijan.
We have debt, we have a wounded, buildings are damaged, people need help. Not just financial help, but also moral support. We do what we can, raise money. People are happy to help.
The Armenian diaspora in Los Angeles has also taken steps to draw attention to the conflict, demonstrating and organizing rallies near TV channel and newspaper headquarters. Some U.S. politicians are speaking out.
And I urge the Trump administration to conduct the sustained and rigorous diplomacy necessary to bring peace to the region now.
As the fighting over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh grows worse, the International Committee of the Red Cross says civilians are bearing the brunt, with civilian deaths and injuries reported on both sides of the conflict. Frangelina Bogdasaryan in Los Angeles, NRI's VOA News.
Tens of thousands of people marched through the center of the Belarusian capital of Minsk on Sunday to demand that authorities free political prisoners. Police turned water cannons on the protesters. Reuters reporter Libby Hogan has more.
Security forces in Belarus detained dozens of protesters on Sunday, firing rubber bullets and letting off water cannons spraying colored water to mark people for arrest. Police wearing balaclavas were seen dragging away protesters into unmarked vans and beating them with batons. It was a rally that drew thousands onto the streets of the capital and other cities across the country. Protests in Belarus have entered their third month. People have taken to the streets every week. Demands include leader Alexander Lukashenko to step down and a new election after a vote in August that was widely seen as rigged. Sunday's violence followed a meeting Lukashenko held on Saturday in a Minsk jail with detained opposition leaders, an unusual event that prompted some opposition activists to believe he was preparing to make concessions. In a rare compromise, two people who had taken part in the meeting were released on Sunday, state TV reported. Security forces have detained more than 13,000 people during the post-election crackdown. And opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who fled to Lithuania, has also called for new elections and for all political prisoners to be freed.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. In recent months, unpredictable, intense floods have washed across parts of Kenya, Sudan, Ethiopia, and several other Eastern and Central African countries, ruining homes and livelihoods. At the same time, people and governments are battling a global pandemic. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to those affected in Uganda.
Paradise in peril. As the world battles a pandemic, large swaths of the African continent have been submerged by floods. This is the scene in the eastern Ugandan city of Jinja, along the shores of Lake Victoria. Since March, flooding has left more than 400 people dead in East Africa. In Uganda, Catholic Relief Services estimates that as many as 580,000 people are affected, from nice lakeshore homes in Kampala to small farms along the Kenya border.
And you're a smallholder farmer who normally benefits from farming on a riverbank, and suddenly there's this raging flash flood that comes down the hills and mountains because of this very intense rainfall. You lose everything.
In the town of Jinja, radio host and environmental activist John Hillary says flooding doesn't just destroy homes, it ruins the very fabric that holds society together.
The public hospital, the only public hospital in the Chilembe region, completely destroyed. So people, as a result of the floods, got sick, but they could not get anywhere else to go to because the hospital had been destroyed.
Dehwe says heavy rainfall is normal in East Africa. What isn't is the frequency and intensity seen lately. He says Uganda is facing a triple threat that's making it even harder for groups to help.
We have the locusts, we have all the floods, and then on top of everything else, we have COVID-19. And so it's been, for the affected people, it's been an especially hard year, to be on a lockdown and be affected by floods, and then because of the lockdown, accessing the support and the relief that they are entitled to.
Hillary, who has a radio show, speaks often about climate change. He grew up on a farm, so for him, this is personal.
Over time, we have noticed that because of what I think is negligence, we have been involved in practices that have completely destroyed our rain cycle. Our climate is deteriorating every other day. I'm only 26. I have seen over time, my world deteriorating. I don't want to see the same for my children.
This, he says, is a living nightmare. This is his home, and he wants future generations to see its beauty, too. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And still to come.
I really wanted to tell the story of how the girls got to where they are, the members got to where they are now. I was certainly happy that they did speak about it so openly.
This is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. Fans are paying tribute to Eddie Van Halen with memorials in his childhood hometown. Born in the Netherlands, the rock guitarist moved to Pasadena aged 7, where shrines of flowers and messages are being left. Paris Hilton is calling for her old boarding school in Utah to be closed. After speaking out about the abuse she said she suffered there, Hilton organized a protest near Provo Canyon School, along with hundreds of others who said they also experienced abuse at schools for troubled youth. ABBA's Bjorn Ulvaeus lent his support to Sunday's UN International Day of the Girl Child by speaking up for strong girls and citing Greta Thunberg as an example. In a piece of writing, he said he grew up in a world where his education was valued more than his sister's, and he doesn't want young women to face the same obstacles. This is Hilary Fox with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. At a press briefing on Monday, the World Health Organization's Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, warned that the organization is seeing an increase in the number of novel coronavirus cases, especially in Europe and the Americas.
Each of the last 4 days has been the highest number of cases reported so far. Many cities and countries are also reporting an increase in hospitalizations and intensive care bed occupancy.
Dr. Tedros also called relying on so-called herd immunity scientifically and ethically problematic.
Never in the history of public health has herd immunity been used as a strategy for responding to an outbreak, let alone a pandemic.
He said allowing a dangerous virus that we don't fully understand to run free is unethical.
There are many things that countries can do and are doing to control transmission and save lives. It's not a choice between letting the virus run free and shutting down our societies.
Dr. Mike Ryan is the executive director of the WHO Health Emergencies Program. He says incidence of hospitalizations and deaths lags behind the number of cases, and it could take weeks for those numbers to be reflected in the system.
But what we are beginning to see worryingly in places like France, like the UK, Ireland, and other countries, is hospitalization rates increasing, ICU occupancy rising. And it's really important that health systems are able to cope with what will be an increasing number of cases in hospital and ICUs over the coming weeks. The question remains as to how many of those daily incident cases convert into hospitalizations and then into very seriously ill patients. And we don't know that. We don't know that for sure.
Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, the COVID-19 technical lead at the WHO, says what they are worrying about is not just the total number of cases, hospitalizations, or deaths.
It's about all of the long-term impacts that we are starting to see in individuals who have even had a mild infection, a mild disease. We are only now starting to really learn of the long-term impacts on the heart, on the brain, on the lungs, on mental health, on people's ability to recover from COVID infection. And so not only do we need to work very hard at reducing mortality, and we are seeing the benefits of that, we still need to reduce the numbers of infections that we are seeing.
The WHO's chief scientist, Dr. Suma Swaminathan, also provided an update on vaccine development.
The COVAX facility is going from strength to strength. October 9th was another deadline for countries to make commitments. And at over the weekend, we have over 180 countries that have committed. These include the self-financing countries, and the latest one to join and make a public announcement was China. As you know, we have about 40 vaccine candidates now in some stage of clinical trials, and 10 of them are in the phase 3 trials, which are the late stage clinical trials, which will tell us about both the efficacy and the safety. So the best that we could make a guess or predict, looking at when a trial started and when it is likely to have enough data to submit to the regulators, is the earliest is starting from December of 2020 into the early part of 2021. We expect a number of clinical trials to start providing data for regulators to look at.
There are about 37.7 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 around the globe. VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website. Lebanon has announced the names of its delegation that will hold indirect talks later this week with Israel over the disputed maritime border between the two countries. Monday's announcement comes 2 weeks after Lebanon and Israel reached an agreement on a framework for U.S.-mediated talks. Talks are scheduled to begin Wednesday at the headquarters of the U.N. peacekeeping force in the southern Lebanese border town of Nakoura. Israel and Lebanon have no diplomatic relations and are technically in a state of war. Microsoft says it has taken legal action seeking to disrupt a major cybercrime digital network that uses more than 1 million zombie computers to loot bank accounts and spread ransomware. Experts consider the botnet a major threat to the U.S. election. The operation to knock offline the command and control servers for the criminal infrastructure known as TrickBot was launched with a court order that Microsoft obtained in a Virginia federal court last week. It's difficult to know how effective the operation will be. The Washington Post reports that a prior attempt by U.S. military personnel to knock the network offline was ultimately unsuccessful. European Union foreign ministers backed a Franco-German plan on Monday to impose sanctions on Russians suspected of poisoning Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny with a nerve agent. EU diplomats told Reuters that there was broad support among the 27 foreign ministers for asset freezes and travel bans on several Russian GRU military intelligence officials. Moscow denies any involvement in Navalny's poisoning. Aboriginal groups have spoken of their grief at an Australian parliamentary inquiry into the destruction by a mining company of sacred sites dating back 46,000 years. In May, Rio Tinto, the world's biggest iron ore miner, destroyed two ancient rock shelters at the Juukong Gorge in Western Australia's Pilbara region as part of a new development, despite fierce opposition from Indigenous groups. Phil Mercer has that story.
Indigenous groups say they're in mourning at the desecration of our sacred sites at the Juukan Gorge. It was blown up by Rio Tinto in pursuit of high-grade iron ore, despite protests by community leaders. Aboriginal witnesses have told a parliamentary committee that Aboriginal culture is undervalued in Australia. The ancient rock shelters destroyed in May were considered some of the country's most significant archaeological research areas. Greg McIntyre is a land rights expert and says tougher laws are needed.
Governments at both state and federal level need to be actively engaged in this and to take a different view about the juxtaposition between economic benefit and Australia's heritage. Heritage has been a very poor second cousin for decades now.
Aboriginal Australians consider the land to be the mother of creation, connecting them to their past, present and future. An Indigenous elder said his people felt immense grief and guilt at their failure to protect such a sanctified site at the Juukan Gorge that dated back tens of thousands of years. Rio Tinto has apologised and is scheduled to give evidence to the inquiry later this week. Three senior Rio executives were forced to quit last month after the scandal. New heritage laws are being drafted in the state of Western Australia to give Indigenous groups a greater say in the protection of their land under the proposals. In the past, some have agreed to sacrifice sacred sites to help their impoverished communities receive a share in mining revenue. The parliamentary inquiry is due to hand down its report in early December. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Life on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota can be harsh. It's poor, it's dangerous, and there are few prospects for girls and young women. But women of the Lakota tribe are taking their life and their future into their own hands, offering the young generation of women new opportunities. Victoria Kupchineski brings us the story.
Your left side. Patience and her sister, AJ, live in one of the poorest communities in the United States, Pine Ridge Reservation, in the U.S. state of South Dakota.
Take it to the gate! Take it to the gate!
Patience is 10 years old. Most of her life, she's been shuttled between her relatives' homes because her parents are not always present in her life.
I mostly go to my grandma's. She took care of me for 2 years. Here you go, you can have the puppy back. Before my grandma took me, I used to have an uncle that took care of me. He got buried out close to Red Cloud School. Yeah, I only go see him once in a while, but I didn't usually see him because it's sad for me.
Patience's great-grandfather hasn't been able to find employment for months. Electric heating is expensive, so they supplement with burning wood.
Her and I, that's four generations.
I'm the Lakota woman. Right? Say yes.
Say Lakota
Wia.
We're here at the Oglala Lakota band. We got a mean loss of identity here due to forced assimilation.
The Lakota tribe were buffalo hunters. They roamed these plains freely for thousands of years. From the late 19th to mid-20th century, U.S. federal policy forced indigenous people to assimilate. The policy called for removing Lakota and other tribes' children from their homes, as well as forbidding them from performing cultural ceremonies and speaking their native languages. They were forced into farming and to live on reservations. Native Americans have gained back some rights, but many still choose to live on reservations where life remains harsh. Pine Ridge Reservation is a geographically isolated place where resources are scarce and crime is rampant. The unemployment rate is 80%. Drugs and alcohol, disappearances of young women, and the absence of law enforcement are all part of life here.
Thank you.
The women of the Lakota tribe are trying to take their lives and their future in their own hands.
I speak for our reservation because this is where I've been. We have to support one another, and we have to bring that together for our daughters and our future.
That's why I feel like these programs are so important, to teach our young girls to have pride in themselves and who they are and how to protect and understand their sacredness.
They're working with the Indigenous Adolescent Girls Empowerment Network, Imagine, to create girl societies on the reservation, safe places in each neighborhood where girls can go every week to have fun, talk about problems, and pursue opportunities.
With the historical oppression that Native American people have experienced here in the U.S., family structures are often broken down. And so girls have a lot more on their plates than boys do in terms of pregnancy risk, in terms of dropping out of school, in terms of having to shoulder the responsibilities of heading a family.
Girl societies are not out of place in Native culture.
The matrilineal traditions in many Native cultures meant there were women societies to get things done. Gender is really such a core piece of who we are as Native people. You know, women have particular strengths and men have particular strengths. We have like roles that we play, and that's how we've survived.
At the first informational meeting, patients and her friends are curious.
How this really works is through mentoring. We want to make sure girls are able to learn about our culture. They're able to learn about the ceremonies.
You'll also learn skills too, like how to prepare to get into college, how to get scholarships.
When Patience grows up, she wants to be a U.S. Air Force pilot, like her aunt.
She said it's a little hard to fly because there's a whole bunch of buttons. I'm like, but I can think I can get them in my head because I'm really strong, so I can do it. And then I also will have a good house and a good life and sometimes take care of my grandpa. Yeah.
Programs like these may help girls like Patience turn their dreams for a better future into reality. Victoria Kuchinetsky, VOA News, South Dakota.
If you're a fan of K-pop, and specifically the group Blackpink, get ready, because Reuters' Edward Baran has this story about a new documentary hitting screens on Wednesday.
Our next guests are the best-charting Korean girl group of all time, K-pop sensations.
K-pop has become a worldwide cultural phenomenon.
Members of K-pop power girl group Blackpink are showing their softer side in a new Netflix documentary. Blackpink Light Up the Sky sees them open up about their journey from teen trainees to global superstars. Director Caroline Soo.
I really wanted to tell the story of how the girls got to where they are, the members got to where they are now. I was certainly happy that they did speak about it so openly, but it kind of just happened organically over time as we got to know each other. So, but I was surprised in the interview how open they were and candid they were about how hard that time was.
Formed by YG Entertainment, Blackpink has become a global phenomenon and the highest-charting K-pop female group of all time since forming in 2016. This year has seen the group collaborate with US heavyweights such as Lady Gaga and with Selena Gomez on the single Ice Cream.
Ice cream, chillin', chillin', ice cream, chillin'. Ice cream, chillin', chillin', ice cream, chillin'.
Sue says youngsters hoping to make it in the world of K-pop joint training programs consisting of hours of daily dance lessons, voice training, and schoolwork, alongside weekly auditions.
I hope that the film humanizes the Blackpink members, so they are seen as more three-dimensional.
Oh, wow!
The film premieres on Netflix on October 14th.
Edward Baran reports for Reuters News. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, have a great day, and once more, here's Ice Cream with Selena Gomez and Blackpink.